You want to know what you need more of in your life? Politics. Yeah, nobody ever said that. But if you've got to go ahead and spend money on one nonfiction book, it's got to be the ultimate clash of wisdom, awesomeness, and then obviously the politics. But why not a little bit of comedy? Why not a little bit of a memoir? Why not something that's going to make you say, hey, I actually enjoyed reading this. I laughed. I learned something in the process. Check out my book. It's an Amazon bestseller. You may have heard of it. It's Stay Away from the Libertarians. It talks about all the things you think you might know about libertarians, plus a lot of things that I bet dollars to donuts you don't know about. You can get it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. So go on right now. You can get it in print or ebook or Kindle or whatever you call it. Just go out and get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble online today. It's Stay Away from the Libertarians by Remso W. Martinez. Happens to be me. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the one, the only Remso Martinez Experience. I'm your host, as always, Remso W. Martinez. Go ahead and do me a quick favor. Go ahead and follow me on Twitter at Remso4VA. That's Remso4VA, R-E-M-S-O-F-O-R-V-A is in Virginia. Follow me, I'll follow you back indiscriminately. That way we can go ahead and keep this awesome conversation going on after the show. And as always, show notes are available at rwmartinez.com. This has been an interesting year for Virginia politics right now. What we have is we already have a former Congressman Scott Taylor jumping into the U.S. Senate race. He was recently endorsed by my former Congressman Barbara Comstock. And apart from that, you know, Virginia Republicans are in bit of a reset period. You know, post 2018 with the campaign of Corey Stewart and everything else, the defeat of Gillespie back in 2017, a lot of people are asking, you know, what's going on in Virginia? Over at the Fear Plus Loathing 2020 podcast over at acejournaltoday.com, I went ahead and spoke with a Republican candidate Republican nominee for House of Delegates, Heather Mitchell, and we spoke about whether or not Virginia's in play. You know, the broader question is, do Virginia Republicans really have the will to fight? And, you know, as we saw in the state legislature yesterday over at the state Senate with all those last-minute gun bills proposed by Republicans to back Governor Ralph Northam, a lot of people are still asking, you know, what is it we're doing? What are we fighting for? And I think that the book we're going to talk about today with the author I have on is really one of those opportunities for a lot of people to ask, where have we been, what have we done, and where are we going? The book I'm talking about today with the author, Joel Hensley, is Richard Obenshain, A Spirit of Fire. I have this description opened up at the Daily News Record. I'll go ahead and post the article online so you can go ahead and see more of an introduction over there. We'll go ahead and discuss everything else on the show. But former chairman of the Republican Party of Virginia, Richard Obenshain, became well known in the world of politics during the early 1960s, 70s, and his name lays across the headquarters of the Republican Party of Virginia in downtown Richmond. But his career was cut short after returning home from a campaign appearance where he won the Republican nomination to run for U.S. Senate. The small twin-engine airplane he was traveling in crashed into trees while attempting to land, killing Obenshain, the pilot, and the flight instructor. The story of Obenshain, who inspired many, comes back to life through the pages of a new book, Richard Obenshain, A Spirit of Fire. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show Joel Hensley. Joel, thank you for joining the program today. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, hey, Remso, I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk a little bit more in depth about Dick Obenshain.
So author to author, I have to ask, because recently I just finished my second book. It's a narrative telling of the life and times of Governor George Wallace. Not necessarily someone as likable as Richard Obenshain, but I'm always curious when people write biographies of other people, especially those who are no longer with us. What kind of prompted you to look into, you know, the life of Richard Obenshain, and, you know, what has this whole experience been like? Give us the whole lowdown.
Well, sure. Well, I'd be happy to. It's been quite a long journey and a long road with this project, and it really started. I'm 33 years old now, but it started when I was an undergrad in college at JMU, and I was taking a course. It was Practical Politics in Virginia was the name of it, and one of our textbooks was a book by Frank B. Atkinson, who wrote The Dynamic Dominion, and that book covered Virginia's modern political history from World War II up until 1980. And he wrote a follow-up book to that called Virginia and the Vanguard, which covered 1980 to 2006. But for the first part of the class, you know, we were discussing the middle 20th century, and Dick Omenchain's name popped up in that book. He was a character, if you will, a part of the larger story. But as I was reading about him, I was becoming more fascinated. And I already knew State Senator Mark Omenchain. My dad and him had been friends, and I knew of him. And I'd heard of his dad, but I really didn't know much about him. And so as we were going through this course, I really just became fascinated and almost felt somewhat of a kindred spirit, bond with this guy. And so I asked my professor, his name was former delegate Pete Giesen, and we called him Professor Pete. And, I was like, why hasn't anyone, written a biography on him? His story is fascinating. There's been 5 books written on Harry Byrd. There's been a memoir published by Governor Linwood Holton. And you have all these others. There's a book that's been published on Mark Warner recently. And so I was just astonished that nobody had written a biography on Dick Omenchain. And so I talked to my professor about it, and he said, well, you're a good writer. Why don't you try it? And so I took the idea to heart. I went to Frank Atkinson and wanted to make sure that, he wasn't already in the process of writing a biography. And what he told me is he originally wanted to write a biography on Dick Omenchain, but it just sort of expanded out into this larger work. So it ended up becoming what it was. And finally, I reached out to the Omenchain family, who I already knew, and made sure I talked to each individual member. Kate Omenchain had expressed interest in wanting to write a book on her dad. But so I wanted to make sure that I wasn't, I wasn't cutting the corner on her. And so she was all for it. Mark was all for it. And of course, his widow, Helen, was in favor of the idea as well. So it kind of took off from there. And that was around 2009 when I really started to take that idea a little bit more seriously. And so here we are close to 10 years later and finally completed it.
Yeah. So far, I mean, I heard about the book through a Facebook advertisement. And, the way I, when I saw it, I was like, wait a second, they spelled Mark Omenchain wrong. Because, that's the only Omenchain I really knew about. Mark Omenchain was probably one of the first people I ever voted for when he was running for attorney general way yonder back. So as I started looking into, your book and everything you were doing and looking more into Dick Omenchain's life, I mean, this was a like he's one of those Republicans that everyone seemed to either love, or if they didn't love him, they respected him. Mm-hmm. And it's really strange how that works, because in Virginia today, not a lot of people like us. Like, that's really changed. But in a strange sort of way, it's like we don't even like each other. Mm-hmm. And it could be for, any large amount of reasons. Do you think it's kind of odd that, this book about a very unifying figure, a leader in the conservative movement, is coming out during a time when we don't even know what's really going on? It's like everyone kind of has their own agenda, and the rest of us are kind of like along for the ride right now.
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate to see that. And one of the signs I've said after doing this book of a great man is somebody who everyone projects their best selves onto. Everyone I interviewed, a lot of these folks who started as Republicans who are now Democrats, who supported Dick Omenchain back in the 70s, or folks who are now, strongly libertarian, type Republicans, and others who are a little bit more establishment type Republicans. Like you said, they all, you know, respect him and admired him. And he it was really very similar to Ronald Reagan and the effect he had as far as being a unifying figure. I relate a lot of that to his personality and to his personal integrity and his character. And, you know, I think everything he did really just kind of pointed in the direction that, you know, he followed the rule that Reagan once said about not talking ill of other Republicans. And he supported people he didn't necessarily philosophically agree with, but he understood the importance of building the party and expanding the party. And sometimes, you know, you might not necessarily agree with that person, but your time will come and your turn will come around as well. And you'll get a chance to express your philosophy soon enough. But it really was a the book really is coalition building 101, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those people, much like Reagan himself. I think that's why they got along so well. But I mean, he wasn't just a good face for the Republican brand, but he was such a eloquent and effective communicator of just conservative principles. I mean, one of my favorite quotes by him is, "The most important goal in my life is to have some significant impact on preserving and expanding the realm of personal freedom in the life of this country." And that's what he did. And it's, you know, it's just such a freaking crying shame that, you know, he was cut down before he could really, you know, really get to work, because he probably would have won that race.
Exactly. And a lot of people like to speculate, too. And back in 1980, when Ronald Reagan, or maybe it was 84, his widow, Helen Obenchain, had attended the national convention when they were nominating Ronald Reagan. And Senator Orrin Hatch came up to Dick Obenchain and – or I'm sorry, Helen Obenchain, and said, you know, Dick would have been on the ticket. That's true or not, or whether it would have happened in the 80s. I mean, his form of conservatism was still popular in 88 and in 92 and even in 96. And so I do think that his name would have continued to expand. I think he would have won re-election. And I do think there's a strong possibility he probably would have ran for president, probably, you know, at least in the 90s.
It's always a shame to look at these people. I mean, a lot of, you know, when you look at political science junkies like ourselves, you know, the wannabe pundit class of Americans, you know, one of the biggest speculations when it comes to an individual's future always tends to go back to, like, you know, Robert F. Kennedy, for example. Oh, what if he had been the nominee in 68? Oh, would he have beaten Nixon? What would he have done about Vietnam? And people like to speculate on that. People like to speculate on Al Gore. But when it comes to Dick Obenchain, I mean, it's one of those. But I think the biggest problem that every generation has is understanding legacies. Mm-hmm. And it's understanding, you know, that we really do stand on the burden of giants, especially when it comes to affecting policy and discourse. And Virginia has always been, you know, I'm not a native Virginian. I've been here since 2008. But I mean, there's this understanding that what we do actually does impact the country, not just as a bellwether state, but just because of, you know, the unique heritage of the Commonwealth. Do you think people have really kind of forgotten that type of way of life? Do you think they've kind of forgotten the things that, you know, Dick Obenchain did to bring back a Republican resurgence in the Commonwealth? Or do you think we kind of just take it for granted?
No, absolutely. I think we're seeing that now in the General Assembly. The General Assembly of Virginia used to be a place of, you know, just the Virginia gentleman. I mean, that's not a myth. I mean, that was that's a very powerful heritage that we have. And I do think that's getting lost. And no offense, but I think a lot of that has to do with Virginia being so transient now because of Washington, D.C.
I'm in Fairfax. I'm in the People's Republic. I'm suffering because of this. Okay.
So you're not in Virginia, technically.
No, I'm in the People's Republic. It's, you know, it's southern D.C.
Right. Yeah, and going back to what you were saying about people not understanding legacies, and that's why I wanted to tell this story. Well, I wanted there to be a story that was focused solely on Dick Obenchain as, you know, sort of the main character, if you will. But also people born after the year 2000, as I was talking to them, like you said, they were familiar with Mark Obenchain, not really familiar with Dick Obenchain, and I think there was a lot of lessons and a lot of information in his story that people can take with them today and apply not just to politics, but also to their own personal lives, how to conduct themselves and also to business as well. I mean,
can I give us an example of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, what was one of the things that kind of stuck out to you?
I think the thing that stuck out to me the most going to his personal integrity was not lying. He had no tolerance for not telling the truth. And there's a story of his daughter, Kate Obenchain. I can't remember what television show it was, but she was watching something on TV and she said they weren't allowed to watch, you know, too many shows. But this one particular, they said, you know, the moral of the story was it's okay to tell a white lie every once in a while if it's, you know, going to prevent you from hurting someone's feelings. And she said Dick Obenchain happened to be walking across the room at that time and raced over to the television screen and turned it off and said, "You'll never watch that show ever again." And he just did not have any tolerance, you know, for that sort of thing.
That's really surprising. I mean, you know, I don't want to discredit him, but like, you know, politics isn't necessarily a career path for saints.
Right. Exactly. And many of the folks I interviewed, that's why a lot of them tended to think that Dick Obenchain wouldn't be involved in politics today. Whether or not that's true or not, that's just how highly many people thought of him. And there's so many stories as far as, you know, a lot of times young folks kind of get brushed aside and aren't really paid attention to. And he really made an effort to mentor them and to give them time and to, you know, grab lunch with them and to really help, you know, cultivate their careers and stuff. And one of the stories I remember from the book was Stan Maupin, who was his driver. They arrived at a event. I think they were speaking to some donors. It was at a hotel, and Dick had forgotten, you know, his luggage in the car, and he asked his driver if he'd, you know, go back and get it for him. And so his driver came back in, brought him his suitcase and luggage, and he was in the middle of talking to these, you know, very wealthy financiers, and paused in the middle of it, looked at Stan and said, "You know, I shouldn't have asked you to grab that. I think it was along the nature of, you know, I'm a big boy, essentially. I can go get these things myself. The next time, Stan, you need something, you ask me and I'll get it for you." And he said he was just so thrown back by the level of courtesy that Dick Obenchain, you know, displayed. And that was just one example. I mean, there were so many folks that I interviewed who had so many stories that were like that. And a lot of them were very small, and they were they weren't really worth putting in the book just because they were, you know, they were so small in nature. But I did include, you know, several of them. And there really was a running theme here from all the people I talked to, and that was that he was a very considerate individual. And I think we do kind of lack that in politics today.
Yeah, I mean, especially like, you know, when you mention his treatment of young people, like, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call myself like the most, you know, I would not call myself like a big defender of like the GOP brand, because mm-hmm. as a millennial and as a, you know, as a Latino, I always felt like growing up, like, you know, my purpose was to be there for photo shoots mm-hmm. and then to be told to go make phone calls and knock doors and just, you know, be seen but not heard. Right. And I know that's how it is for a lot of young Republicans, especially mm-hmm. when they go and they intern and they staff for certain people. I mean, a lot of them have, you know, really great experiences. But, you know, sometimes, you know, more often than not, we've all heard those stories of, you know, the interns are being yelled at, or they're being used as, you know, basically maids and stuff. I mean, it's just I wish like, you know, these are supposed to be the leaders of tomorrow. They're getting involved in party politics now because they're supposed to be trained. And like, you know, we don't necessarily set the best precedents for themselves, and then we wonder why they act the way they do later. Mm-hmm. I feel like the Republican Party, you know, for the most part, has kind of taken young people for granted in that matter.
They have, and I think based on my own experiences, you know, I've seen that as well, and a lot of them get bitter and they get jaded, and that shouldn't be the case. And most of the ones that Dick Obenchain had mentored or, you know, or who had worked for him during his campaigns, they're still involved today, and I think that says a lot too. They haven't lost haven't really lost their way in a lot of ways. And, you know, in some of them, I think the 1980s were a little bit tumultuous. The Republicans lost a lot in the 80s, and the Obenchain factions actually split shortly after he passed away, which I think also goes to show that he was the glue that was holding it all together at that time. And so I think some of them kind of went separate ways around that time, but they still reflect back on Dick Obenchain as being the person that really inspired them to get involved in the first place. And we really don't, at least from not what I'm seeing, I'm not really seeing a whole lot of politicians in Virginia who are really inspiring that degree of enthusiasm or excitement right now.
Yeah, like I'm not – like listen, this is going to tick some people off, but I have been known to kind of sit out an election here and there, because sometimes I look at some of these people and I feel like, especially in Northern Virginia, like it's a killing ground. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely a killing ground. And then I feel bad for like the rest of the Commonwealth. I mean, I worked in the 5th Congressional District for, you know, a former congressman, Tom Garrett, at the time. And I worked a lot of local like city council level stuff. But, you know, like in the southern part of Virginia, even for statewide candidates, they feel like they're just kind of taken for granted and pushed aside. So that way they can, you know, they can go and appease the transient population of Northern Virginia. And, I mean, it's true. I see it. You see, you have a lot of statewide candidates that come up here, and they spend a majority of their time here, and usually it's Northern Virginia that gets a majority of the attention. And it's a strange time to be a Republican, because I'm not even really convinced that we're really a battleground state anymore. We might be a giant, you know, red state when you look at the map overall, but it's Northern Virginia that just kind of dictates things.
Yeah, and it's really scary to see, it almost seems like Burden Machine 2.0 just around the corner. And, people talk about voter fraud. There's actually a incident in the book in which Dick actually took a break from his campaign to go represent some precinct captains over in – I think they called them something different back then. I think they called them precinct directors or something like that.
Oh, that sounds way more official. We need to bring that back.
I had to do a double take on it just to, you know, see if I was understanding, you know, who it was he was representing. But they basically refused to count certain ballots that they knew were coming from. They called it the Black Satchel case, and it happened in Dickinson County. And they actually were finding ballots that were coming from Tennessee. So there was voter fraud happening.
How the hell does that happen?
I don't know the exact ins and outs of it, but Dick basically went to represent the Republicans over there for free and took a break from his campaign just to do that. And the great thing in the story is how that comes full circle later on in his Senate race. And Dickinson County, you know, was Holton territory, and during the 78 race. And so when Holton dropped out, those folks remembered what he did for them back then, and so they ended up throwing their support behind Dick at that convention.
Oh, wow.
People forget that Virginia was, you know, dominantly in the hands of Democrats at the local level until the 1990s, really. Before that, they were having statewide success, and they were having winning at the presidential level and U.S. Senate level. But at the local level, at the courthouse level, and at the General Assembly level, it was still very much in control of Democrats for the longest of times.
It's kind of weird, because that's, you know, if you kind of think about it, that's kind of like the same way it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, it blew my mind. I think it was like a week ago, 2 weeks ago, when Charlottesville like destroyed the idea of Thomas Jefferson Day or whatever. Like, it's gotten to the point where, you know, as someone that's managed multiple city council races in Lynchburg, of all places, like, you look at that place, it has more churches than anywhere in the world, other than, like, I don't know, the Vatican, for example. But it's almost all entirely run by Democrats. And when you look at a lot of local seats throughout the Commonwealth, you know, whether it's Dogcatcher or Soil and Water or whatever, like, you know, Republicans don't really run for those positions anymore. And I think a lot of them just, like, I don't want to say they're demoralized, but there's just a greater sense of apathy. And I feel like as years have gone by, since really 2010, like, you know, the past 9 years, it's like they don't really want to fight anymore. Not necessarily it's because of a lack of belief in themselves or that they don't have a leader really to kind of do that. Because, you know, as much as we all like to say, oh, we're strong individualists, like, you know, it's sometimes it takes men like Dick Obenshain to kind of give us a kick in the butt to keep us going, keep us in the fight.
Exactly. And I think that's what the Republican Party is sort of lacking today. And you know, we certainly have a lot of very tremendous public servants that are active right now. And but you're right. There really is no central figure who is sort of the guy that's, you know, pulling all these different factions together and excuse me. And, you know, it's sort of being the peacemaker between them. It seems like everyone has their own camp, and, you know, they're staying in that camp, and they're not really seeing the forest from the trees, if you will. So it would be nice if someone like that. I mean, there will never be another Dick Obenshain, and just like there will never be another Ronald Reagan. But Virginia, the Republican Party of Virginia, definitely needs somebody who is respected on all those various factions, who can sort of understand them and be able to pull them together and say, okay, here's, you know, here's the direction we need to go in order to win again. And, you know, I definitely think it's sad that we don't have that right now. And it just goes to show, you know, how rare it is to have a Dick Obenshain, you know, in any generation, and which I think makes his story a little bit more, you know, special and interesting in that way.
So we're about to wrap up the show. This is a question I always ask authors who write biographies, because I think it's, you know, it's a unique question for this specific genre. But, you know, as you were researching him, as you were writing his life, you know, did you change at all? You know, did your outlook on anything change positively, negatively? How'd that go?
It did, and not to sound strange, but it was almost as if I was taking on it was almost as if I felt like I was taking on Dick Obenshain's perspective on things. Just, you know, I almost, I don't want to toot my own horn, but I almost felt like I was starting to get a grasp on, okay, how would he respond to this? How would he respond to that? Almost kind of like a what would Dick Obenshain do mentality. And it's really kind of allowed me – I mean, I haven't been as involved in politics in recent years, but it's really allowed me to not get overly heated, I guess, with anything that's going on right now, and just hoping that a lot of these sides can come together and can really start to listen to each other and realize that, you know, the Republican Party can be a big tent and it can be open to a lot of people. We just, you know, we can't be excluding people for the, you know, silliest minute reasons. And so I guess it sort of changed me in that way. It kind of reaffirmed a lot of my own philosophy and my own beliefs, as I almost felt like I could kind of trace his philosophical legacy, you know, going back to Austrian economics and some folks that I admire too. And so, you know, I get the question a lot of times, who would Dick Obenshain support today? And that's something I don't really like to answer. But
I hate it when people ask that type of question, because, you know, like as biographers, in a way, like we are in a strange sense, kind of like gatekeepers to a legacy. Because, like, for example, like I wrote a book about someone that's not necessarily what most people would consider, you know, a water cooler conversation. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, I had a lot of, you know, presuppositions about, like, George Wallace, for example, like the villain of the civil rights movement. But, right, like, you know, the one thing I tell people at the end is, like, you know, I don't hate the man. If anything, mm-hmm, I feel bad for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I wrote about him, like, I could see his humanity in certain things, because, mm-hmm, like everyone else, like, you know, we all make mistakes. He made some bad mistakes. But, you know, what we also don't talk about is the latter end of his life, where, you know, he really did try to fix things. Like, he tried to atone for that. Like, he was a born-again Christian, and he died trying to bring together Southern whites and Southern blacks. So, like, in that sense, it's like, you know, you end up really respecting the people that you write about, but you don't ever feel like you can speak on their behalf, because you know better than that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people today try to they were almost trying to, like I said, project themselves onto Dick Obenchain. And I'm aware that folks are doing that. But I'm also aware that they're doing that because he was a great figure. And so I try to stay away from that. But his story overall, it was a hero's arc, you know, story. He really had a hero's journey, and he started with the dream in childhood of he wanted to be a U.S. senator. And his goal in life, of course, that you mentioned, was to have some significant impact in expanding the realm of personal freedom in the United States. And in the book, I mentioned he didn't succeed in obtaining his dream. He fell short of that, but he did succeed in his goal, and I think he definitely had an impact on expanding liberty in this country just from all the people that he inspired and paving the way for the Reagan Revolution.
Absolutely. What would Dick A. Obenchain do? That's a question that I think we should all ask ourselves more often. Joel, if anyone wants to learn more about the book, get a copy. I mean, I think everyone should get a copy. I want to get an autographed copy, so let's talk about this after the show. But how can people learn more about your book?
Sure. So you can get it on Amazon, but we've been directing people to www.dickobenchain.com, and you can order a copy through there. It's available as an e-edition, a Kindle, and also in paperback right now. And so I'll be at some of the various events coming up in this next year, and some of the local Republican committee meetings are having me come to speak there. So people can order books, directly from me at these places as well. So, www.dickobenchain.com.
Perfect. Joel Hensley, everybody. Richard Obenchain, A Spirit of Fire. That's about it, folks. Go ahead and grab this copy. And, you know, this is an interesting time, and I think it's always important to remember her first values first, and a cornerstone for everything should be expanding personal liberty. As always, if you enjoy this conversation, go ahead and share this podcast with a friend. Let them know about the Remso Martinez Experience on iTunes, Google Play, and Anchor.fm. As always, I'm Remso W. Martinez, America. Good night.